Most of you know this is essentially a Theravada group, which means we mostly focus on the early teachings of the Buddha. But I do have a Mahayana part of me, and once in a while I share that. And Sims does that once in a while too, Seattle Insight. So, this is 2026. And by the way, I was moved to think, if any of you have any ideas about what you'd like to hear about, do tell me, because a few people had some really cool ideas this year, which we did. So just want to. Thank you. There you go. See, that's why we're a team. Is that working now? Okay, sweet. All right. So I brought props. So there's this great text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and by Shantideva, who I'll talk about, but here's one translation by Alan Wallace. Here's one translation by the Padmakara Translation Group. I had another one that was the original one I had that came out of the Tibetan Library of Works and Archives by Stephen Batchelor, which I really like, and I just can't find it. I got that one in India in 1991, I think. I think it was falling apart the more I think about it, and that's why I can't find it. And then this is treasured. One of my very first two Buddhist teachers back in 1987 was Venerable Genlao Rinpa. And has anybody been to Cloud Mountain? Done a retreat at Cloud Mountain? Well, some of you know Diamond Hall, which is the main hall, was built for a year-long shamatha retreat that was co-led by Genla and Alan Wallace, as a matter of fact. They co-led this year-long retreat. And Genla was amazing, and he came here twice. And it's the only time he ever came to the West. Was to Seattle because of Alan and the connections. And I did a 3-month retreat in India with him as my guide. I was in one hut and he was a mile through the woods and I saw him once a week. This is his copy of Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. When he died, some of his stuff was shared with people. So this is his copy of that very text. And is printed at the pleasure of Elegant Sayings Printing Press in Sarnath. I never saw that before. That's pretty funny. But anyway, he's even got little tabs, things he liked. I don't know. But anyway, it's all in. There's not notes, but he has little tabs, little plastic tabs sticking out. But I just treasure it, because this very text, it's a very important text in Tibetan Buddhism. And so he studied that. It's so amazing. So touching on what. One of my colleagues, one of us, just said about, I'm sorry, Neha. It's difficult times out there. And I'm talking about politics for everybody. It's difficult, no sides. And sometimes our greatest enemy can be our greatest teacher on the spiritual path. And that's kind of what I want to talk about tonight, how our greatest enemy can be our greatest teacher. And this is only the case if we're willing and able to look deeply enough in our practice to see that that is so. Because most of the world, our greatest enemy is that whom we fight and oppose and dislike. But that's not at all the way it has to be. And there's an opportunity to see it completely differently, which is actually transformational, which is why Shantideva was so incredible. And in terms of Shantideva, this inversion from the mundane of oppositional to a transcendent reversal almost view of difficult people and lives is the core of the famous sixth chapter of this book. The sixth chapter on patience to the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life is, you look it up on the line, it's renowned. And this book is often considered one of the top three books in Tibetan Buddhism that people refer to constantly. And the other two are really hard to understand, and this is really easy to understand, which is a part of why people love it so much. A little bit about the book. It was offered in the 8th century by a otherwise not very well known or Indian monk. So he's an Indian person in India, Shantideva. He was, there's a, I don't know, who's been to India? Well, you folks have been to India, right? Some India persons have been there. So there was a university, Nalanda University in Bihar, in what is now Bihar, for 700 years, that was the center of Buddhist training for the entire Buddhist world. And all these great masters went in and out of there. Padmasambhava trained there, Atisha, all kinds of people you hear about were all came out of Nalanda or taught there or studied there, as did Shantideva. But he's kind of funny because the story goes, he was considered a kind of a useless monk who did nothing but eat and sleep. People had a low opinion of Shantideva. So, you know, supposedly, I don't know, the other monks set him up for a fall. So they said, okay, give us a talk. And he said, okay, I'll give you a talk. And they built him this big throne that he could be up on. So when he messed up, it'd be like kind of spectacular. And he gave this. He just gave the guided bodhisattva's way of life. And people were so stunned. It was so amazing that supposedly he floated up in the air afterwards. And so, you know, take it as you will. But that is, it seems like that's where it actually came from, is there. That part seems relatively established, and it really works. Because in this particular chapter, the whole book is astonishing. I mean, highly recommend it if you be a support to your practice, wherever you are, however you work at Guided Bodhisattva's Way of Life. But here in 2026, and in reference to what Niha was referring to, did I say that right, Niha? Okay, yes. The essence of the text is way it helps us invert our normal reactive polarizing views of how things are, of how we are with people we don't agree with in particular. And, you know, most of the electorate, if you will, most people are pretty, at this particular moment, kind of ensconced in the view that if those other ones that I disagree with, they are bad and are enemies. I mean, on every side of the political spectrum, there's this kind of animosity, and you all know that's really too bad. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to think that the only response to those with whom we disagree is to defeat them. We don't have to have an oppositional relationship with them. It can be completely different. So Shantideva, he inverts this on multiple levels just through this process of going beyond the fundamental ignorance of thinking there's a concrete I and a concrete you and we're separate, going beyond that to a real, just a transcendent understanding that transforms our whole sense of our relationship with people. And this text, so it isn't just about compassion, although it is about compassion, but it's not just about compassion in the way we might think of it, where it's just kindness and gentleness, which compassion is, but it isn't just about that. It's also a wisdom text because it penetrates our normal assumptions in a really powerful way. So radical inversion. So, you know, I did some work on it. Here's six. This is key points, what I kind of pulled out. You can slice and dice it different ways, but some of the ones that people resonate with. And you could go at it different ways in any case. So one is pointing out the causes and conditions behind what people do. And causes and conditions is a term you'll run into in the Buddha Dharma a lot, because it means that here we are, and we have thoughts, we have actions, we have aspects of our personalities, as do everybody we come in contact with, and none of that came in a vacuum. There's causes and conditions. There's reasons why. Every aspect of what comes up in us, we have free will. But nonetheless, there's origins. You know, in this lifetime, that's why people go to psychologists, you know, my mother did whatever. That's why people have these conversations and maybe other lifetimes, depending on how you see things. But causes and conditions, just this whole sense of that is really important in the Dharma and what the Buddha taught. And this comes up certainly in our sitting. I mean, I was literally personally amused a few times during a sit, like, what? This thing came up about experiencing drowning and what that would be like in the North Sea. I went through this like little fantasy of drowning and how that's, where did that come from? You know, I don't know. I'm not planning to drown, but I'm just saying we don't know what brings stuff up in us. Maybe you all had some funny things too. I don't know. We can share afterwards, right? But it's sort of an amusing phenomenon almost. What goes on in us And that which we think we are is in many ways essentially built up. We're like a big mosaic of all these different causes and conditions, all these factors all operating all the time. We don't even know half of them. They're subconscious, they're repressed, whatever, this or that. So it's kind of amazing. So the text, I'm going to read a few little parts of the text because they're little verses is what they are. So verse 25, all defilement of whatever kind, the whole variety of evil deeds are brought about by circumstances. None is independent. None is autonomous. 26, conditioned once assembled, have no thought that they will now give rise to some result, nor does that which is engendered think that it has been produced. So this is sort of talking about the automatic nature of this. It's not like I think this through and plan this. It just happens. All things then depend on other things, and these likewise depend. They are not independent. Knowing this, we will not be annoyed at things that are like magical appearances. You know, and you just think about how we are with other people. And it's kind of like, it's sort of, how do I say, it can be accordion-like. You know, there's little delicate things, this little fantasy I had, whatever little aspects of you. And then there might be, without naming names, there might be some despots in the world doing things that are very alarming, that we dislike a lot. But where'd that come from? You know, the impetus, the view, the thought, somehow that made sense. There's causes and conditions. It's just as embarrassingly random seeming as it is when I'm thinking about drowning in the North Atlantic. Or whatever you all thought about came up when you were practicing. I bet you could also tell funny things about what came up for you. So it's like that for everybody. And this gets to the, you know, the subtle question of self, of not self, right? Not self. Is there an inherent person there? Can we find an inherent person? If that which we think we are is this product of just causes and conditions emerging, where do you find the self there? We're just put together from all these moving parts. So we start with ourselves. We see that in our practice. We see it. It gets clearer and clearer over time. You know, the more you practice, the more you start to see this. Things emerge over and over again, qualities and aspects, and it starts to thin. Rodney Smith used the verb thinning a lot, and I thought that's really apt, because, or even places, you know, some neurotic pattern that we dislike, some compulsive aspect that we don't like, some trauma that just is buried in our heart, it seems like. But over time, you know, we do work with it, we keep seeing it, and it starts to thin. It doesn't grab us in the same way. And that we also can have the same sense of other, because we're being mindful internally and externally. So what about something in the person we're closest to, which really bugs us, that they keep doing, some attitude they have that, you know, we love them a lot, and only that thing, or, you know, a family member, whatever. Sorry, we just had a little talk about that. Yeah. Anyway, but anything like that. But we start to see that there's no inherent dislikable person there. There's causes and conditions happening. It really changes things. So it kind of wipes clean animosity or self-hatred. Self-hatred, animosity, they kind of get wiped clean. And then that whole, you know, separation thing that we're talking about, it's not quite so intense, concretized anymore. It just takes the edge off it. So we can wish that people wouldn't do harmful things. We can oppose them. You know, we can march. We can work for politicians. We can become a politician. We can do whatever, but we don't have to hate them. My brother's a politician, or he was a politician, and he was pretty good about that. It was hard, but he was pretty good about not having animosity towards those who were opposing. It was good to watch. Then a second understanding that kind of comes from this tolerant, this understanding of wisdom. It's basically a wisdom perspective we're talking about, seeing through the concretized nature of things, is actual compassion. Because we more clearly see that as beings are acting out of their condition, on some level doing what they do for reasons that aren't clear to them, and suffering because of it, because it's compulsive, it's grasping, that there you suffer. If we don't do things compulsive, we can, you know, there's a whole distinction between pain and suffering. We can experience pain, but we won't suffer from it. We'll just experience pain. That's a whole different deal. But we have this compassion, seeing what people are doing and seeing what ourselves are doing and how that brings suffering. And we see how beings whose actions we dislike are bringing harm upon themselves. Maybe in the short run, maybe in the long run, but they are. If someone's doing damaging acts to others, for instance, they're bringing harm upon themselves, and compassion arises. And the text says, thus, when enemies or friends are seen to act improperly, remain serene and call to mind that everything arises from conditions. If things could be according to their wish, no suffering would ever come to anyone of all embodied beings, for none of them wants pain of any kind. Yet carelessly, all unaware, they tear themselves on thorns and ardent in pursuit of wives and goods. They starve themselves of nourishment. I kind of read that as inner nourishment, you know? They starve themselves of the inner light of being present, being aligned in this moment. And then from this understanding of compassion, the third one is our anger is undermined. Because if there's no inherent other and their actions are based on conditions damaging themselves in the biggest sphere, what's there to be angry about in terms of negativity or hatred toward them? Text says, although we almost never feel compassion for those who through defilement bring about their own perdition, what purpose does our anger serve? If those who are like wanton children are by nature prone to injure others, there's no reason for our rage. It's like resenting fire for being hot. So isn't that interesting? Like resenting fire for being hot. We're recognizing this is the quality they have right now for whatever reason. And sure, there's free will, but still, this is the quality they have right now. So there's no hatred toward them. And coming out of compassion, not anger toward them, which doesn't mean not opposing them. Doesn't mean not opposing them. But it does mean not hating them or thinking there's something is, you know, heinous about them, that whole concretization of other, they're evil, we're not. You know, it goes both ways. You know, anybody who thinks there's an other group that we're really, but they think that this way. So we really got to take that in and not do it. And then anger, this is such an interesting question because it's actually how the text begins, is talking about anger. And for, you know, we 21st century Westerners, this is a difficult subject because, and especially under the heading of empowerment of women and stuff like that, there's a time when anger seems like, yeah, that's a good thing. And on one way, sure it is. Conventionally speaking, yeah, it is. But in terms of hatred, maybe not. That distinction, maybe not. It's very interesting. So some, you know, maybe some righteous indignation. Is that the right word? I'm not even sure about that one. But some, well, I'll back up and say, one thing that's really interesting in Tibetan tradition, again, has anyone seen these, you know, tankas, these big paintings of Tibetan yidams are called, meditational deities? And like, there's one called Haruka, which is a wrathful compassion. There's lots of wrathful, compassionate forms in Tibetan Buddhism. And it's really useful to contemplate that, what that means. I found this very helpful in terms of this question of anger. It's a little bit like, well, it's not even like, it's a little bit like if we're a parent and our kid's about to, or just jumped out in the road for the third time, a little wrathful compassion might be a good thing, you know, right? So it's kind of like that. It's compassion, but it expresses in a forceful way. But that may be what people need, but the essence is compassion. So those yidams I find very, very useful. So on a conventional level, how we express ourselves an expression of anger might be useful on an ultimate level, if it comes down to hatred of others, then it's not. It's actually hatred of others, and it's just not useful because there's no other to hate, for one thing. What exactly, if there's no ultimate being there and we're expressing hatred, what's going on? Who are we hating? There's no ultimate being there. It's a bunch of, you know, a process going on. And ultimately, it's misguided because it brings the backlash of obscuring our own ability to see clearly. If we have hatred towards others, then we're putting ourselves in a mind of hatred. And that backfires, because that's who we become. You know, that's who we become, and that doesn't help us. So to get into that state of mind is going away from the goal of the spiritual path, which is to have compassion, but also to be happy. You know, to be happy and in this inner sense of freedom and light. So it completely backfires if we actually ever get into, when we get into hatred towards another. So we concretize self, we concretize other. It's the opposite direction from awakening. So the text, it starts right at the very beginning, the very first stanza. It says, all the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity and offerings to the blissful ones, a single flash of anger shatters them. Take that as you will, but I would consider it a single flash of hatred is what they're saying. Maybe not anger arising, you know, I feel angry. Okay, fine. Hatred, that's the deal, where we focus with a sense of wanting ill or animosity toward another. And this takes us, I think six things here. So one of the most compelling and paradoxical statements of the text, our greatest enemy is our greatest teacher. Our greatest enemy is our greatest teacher. And this is where it really gets useful and helpful. And how hard this is, because, you know, our natural inclination is to think that our greatest enemy is our greatest enemy in the story, period, right? He who does the most, he or she, but probably he, who does the most damage to us must be the one we should demonize and oppose with vivid anger and intensity, you'd think. But history shows this doesn't accomplish anything. There's no room for healing. And the stuff we've been talking about, there's actually no enemy to hate. There's no intrinsic actions to hate. And that hating that other will damage us. So how is our greatest enemy our greatest teacher? And this gets into the patience thing. Because it's precisely just at that moment when we want to hate them that we look through it. That's the teacher part. Just when we want to concretize, we open up and see through it. That's what's bringing wisdom. It's hard. It's really hard. But that is the doorway that's right there in that moment. And, you know, for those of you who are, obviously, you know, I've been married 36 years. I love my wife dearly. We have moments, right? And she's never the enemy, but there's times when, you know how it is. I'm the worst person in the room, that's for sure, you know. And it gets hard sometimes, you know, it gets hard sometimes. But to keep remembering that, what can we learn here? What can we learn? We don't actually have fights. I really appreciate that. There's arisings and we listen and we get through it and we learn. And this is the thing that could have been a fight becomes other, becomes an opening. And there's a learning from it. So it's like that. Because this very fire of anger arising, it cuts through the concrete sense of self like a knife through butter. It's just like, it's really powerful. Like whenever, and for any of those kind of things, if you find yourself getting really stirred up, either it's anger or frustration or greed or envy, any of that strong stuff, use that as a moment of practice. Go, oh, look, watch it. You know, it's not a bad thing. Like, I'm doing a bad thing. It's not like that, but it's like, oh, what's going on? And we can see how vividly we're creating self right there. It can be a real opening. But one of the most important ones is anger, because that is so fiery. And to use that as an opening. The Dalai Lama is so incredible in so many ways. But he's an exemplar of this in real life, you know, a world figure, because arguably he has much more to be angry about than most of us. I mean, his country was invaded, taken over. 1 million people died during the Cultural Revolution. Most of the monasteries were destroyed. And the Chinese, I mean, this is not about the Chinese, but the administration on the other side has been consistently difficult. And there's, even now, they're just culturally demolishing Tibetan culture. And he always says he doesn't hate Chinese leaders. He expresses compassion toward them, thinking about their future lifetimes. It's really genuine. He never, you just can't find it. It's just his compassion. And he also says they have become some of his greatest teachers because they give him the opportunity to practice patience and to see through. It's pretty amazing. So that he talks about this. I've heard him talk about this very thing a number of times. So this application of Shantideva's teachings is one of the hallmarks of what he offers to the world at a time when, you know, people are very polarized. And this kind of brings us to the title of the chapter, Patience, and the way, and through what we've been exploring, it's become broader and of more ultimate understanding than just being patient. Because, you know, common usage, what is, we think patience like sitting in the checkout line, I'm just being patient, you know, this kind of passive, kind of oblivious kind of thing we do. Or someone's, and usually it's when someone, like, someone's fumbling or we think someone's being stupid, we're kind of being a little bit patronizing and patient and judgmental all at once and frustrated, all that stuff. But this is completely different, what Shantideva was talking about. So it just turns us from the conventional to the ultimate. And it's an opportunity, because we could react, but we can do something different in a transcendent way, practice patience. You know, to look through the conventional toward the ultimate is pretty amazing. This kind of a real life moment, which the practice offers us in so many ways. But this is a real beautiful way of seeing that. And it reemphasizes, you know, there's no solid other who did the harm. There's no solid me who was harmed. So then kind of solve a big thing right there. Just there's causes and conditions happening. You know, and there's these great stories on, I won't talk about it much, but I've talked about it a number of times here that really, I think, are really striking, and Theravada tradition about Angulimala, the first serial killer, killed 999 people, tried to kill the Buddha. It's a long story, but he wasn't able to because he couldn't catch him because of the special powers of the Buddha, perhaps. But the Buddha said, stop. And Angulimala got it, and he stopped. And he ended up becoming awakening in that lifetime from someone who had done these heinous acts. So something changed in him. So the point being, there wasn't an evil Angulimala. There was a being who was making decisions for some reason. And there's a similar thing in Tibetan Buddhism with Milarepa, who engineered the death of his uncles and aunts and stuff, because they had been unkind to his mother, causes and conditions, and then ended up awakening also. So was Milarepa, you know, it's not that there is no such thing. We can't awaken. Things happen. So we're only sentient beings caught in karma. And this, from this arises compassion. A real, you know, the more we look at this, we really want to help. We see that beings are caught in this web. It brings compassion. It's part of what's so beautiful about the Mahayana tradition, because it has this kind of extra level of compassion more vividly expressed than is quite so obvious in Theravada. And then this is a very, right at the very end of the text in the dedication, there's an extremely famous four lines that the Dalai Lama quotes all the time. It says, for as long as space endures and for as long as living beings remain, until then, may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. For as long as space endures, and for as long as living beings remain, until then, may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. Let's just sit for a minute.